Welcome to the Artist Mother Podcast, featuring interviews with incredible working artists who are also mothers and compelling conversations regarding parenting and the art world. These conversations create a space for inclusivity and support for artist mothers worldwide. I'm Kaylin Butine, painter, mom of three, and podcast host. I'm so grateful you are tuning in, and I hope you enjoy this episode.
I think for me, sometimes it's hard to feel like, is what I'm doing even really matter? Like, to what extent does this, you know, 400-page dissertation about weird, amazing sound poetry in 1960, like, what is that doing for the world? I mean, that sounds very grandiose, but like, what am I adding, I guess, to the conversation with whatever I put out? And so those are questions that I'm trying to think about for myself and to use that process of reflection to calibrate kind of what I do next or what I do with the writing and research I've already done.
I'm so pleased to share information about our sponsor for this episode, Globe Inn. Globe Inn is a monthly subscription of fair trade goods from all around the world. They provide beautiful, inspiring artisan boxes that are shipped right to your door. And these actually contain a curated collection of handmade items for your home. These items can include everything from Moroccan ceramics to hand-woven Mexican baskets, tea, coffee, or other little food items and goodies. I loved the cozy box that I got. It had a gorgeous hand-painted mug, and my kids and I shared some hot chocolate. It was just such a great treat. So you can actually take $20 off your first box for any 3-month subscription, which is 50% off your first box, using promo code ARTISTMOTHER, all caps, ARTISTMOTHER. So the special thing about this company, Globe Inn, is that every purchase supports artisans in remote communities. Globe Inn is a verified member of the Fair Trade Federation, which means they pay artisans a reliable wage which covers all their basic needs. Every product is connected to powerful stories of the artisans who created them, and you can read all about these stories in a little booklet that comes with your box every month. It was a lot of fun to read through that with my kids. Every month, Globe Inn has 4 to 5 brand new box themes that you choose as your monthly selection. They also make available any of their previous bestsellers, or you can actually be surprised. You can select that option where they send whatever they choose for you, and it's kind of fun to see what you get. Everything is good, so it doesn't really matter. You also have the option of customizing your subscription box. You can select redeem and put your box credit towards individual fair trade goods that are on sale in the monthly add-on section. Every month, Globe Inn also has an artisan fund where they raise money for one of the artisan groups they partner with for programs they request, like education or different building projects. Globe Inn has a really active community of like-minded women on Facebook. You can go find this group called Mavens Community, which has over 10,000 members. Certainly, you can find someone you can connect with and talk about shopping ethically there. Globe Inn is a monthly subscription box which costs $40 a month. However, you can pay in advance for the year and it can come down to $33 a month. And don't forget, you can use the coupon ARTISTMOTHER, all caps, for $20 off your first box. You can skip a box or cancel anytime. So check out globein.com, GLOBEIN.com, to see this incredible company who are supporting artisan workers all across the globe. Their products are inspiring, beautiful, and, best part, ethical. Thank you to Globe Inn for sponsoring this episode of the Artist Mother Podcast. Caitlin Woolsey is an art historian and poet based in the Northeast. In her work, she explores the intersections of sound and the visual arts, poetry, performance, and media. Caitlin just completed her PhD in modern and contemporary art history at Yale and is now a postdoctoral research fellow at the Clark Art Institute Research and Academic Program in Williamstown, Massachusetts. She has held positions at a number of museums and recently co-curated an exhibition on experimental poetry and the avant-garde. In addition to teaching and writing, Caitlin explores a variety of artistic media, ceramics, lino cuts, watercolor, and collage. She has 2 young children. Caitlin and I have been friends for several years, and I'm excited to welcome her to the podcast today. Caitlin, thanks so much for being on the Artist Mother Podcast.
Thanks so much for having me, Caitlin.
Of course, it's my pleasure. And it's been a long time coming, as you know. we don't need to go into the backstory, but yeah. So I'm really excited to have you on, you know, just because I guess you're the first art historian that I've had on. And I'm excited to kind of talk about your path, you know, diverging from like a studio artist to choosing to be an art historian and academic. But first, if you'll start by just kind of telling us, you know, something about your childhood or the way that you grew up that you feel like led you to being interested in art, and a little bit about the trajectory that you've taken that got you to today.
Sure. Well, thank you again so much for inviting me. And I've really enjoyed listening through the podcast this past year. And I feel like a lot of my sort of childhood background leading towards thinking about art and art history actually is grounded in questions of stories and storytelling. My father studied and taught children's literature at a college, or several liberal arts colleges. And so stories were a huge part of my childhood, as well as making and sort of hand projects and handcrafts through my mom. And so I think those two sort of strands or threads run throughout not just my childhood, but also my professional life. And as is probably evident by the fact that I'm an art historian, but also a poet. So as a child, I did a lot of drawing and writing, I think as a lot of kids do, but perhaps because of the influence of my parents and my dad in particular, I would dictate stories to him as like a 4 or 5 year old, and he would write them out or type them up, and then I would illustrate them, and we would sort of, you know, make them into little books and things. And so that kind of interest in how illustration, particularly in children's literature, but also how stories and text relates to images, was something that I think was really formative for me. And then in terms of my own writing, my first memory of writing was from probably about the second grade. I finished reading this book, The Giver by Lois Lowry, and was so deeply moved by this story, this kind of dystopian futuristic story that's about memory and stories and color. So lots of things related to the arts. I was so moved by this that I wrote a poem in response to it. And at least that's my first memory of kind of writing.
How old were you?
It was, I think, in second grade.
Okay.
And so kind of jumping ahead, I reached this juncture, the school I went to for middle school and high school, essentially in seventh grade, you had to pick a track. Either you could do music or you could do visual art.
Same school I went to. We'll have to share a little bit about our history at some point too, but keep going.
You sort of had to pick a track, and after doing the mandatory art appreciation class in sixth grade, I wasn't a huge fan of the instructor, and I just thought, okay, I'll do music, I sing, I play an instrument. And so I feel like for me, that was this kind of very arbitrary juncture, which the kind of art making and creative processes that were infused throughout my childhood kind of took a backseat towards writing and music. And I think that's also perhaps a product of my disposition or my personality, which was to feel like I had been sort of praised by others for my writing. And I always felt like I couldn't draw very well or in a very representational way, very successfully. And so I think there was also this sort of kind of anxious, perfectionist, people-pleasing part of myself that kind of migrated towards the activities that I was getting external validation for. I mean, looking back in hindsight, of course, I kind of identify those tendencies. Although I will say my husband, who's an architect, believes deeply that everyone can draw. It's just a matter of kind of practice and what you consider to be successful drawing. So
right.
I always put that
caveat.
What
we're trained to think is
right. Successful or something.
But Yeah. Okay. So let's just pause there so we can, so I can like, you know, cause I'm like over here raising my hand, like me too, because, so just a little backstory, like Caitlin and I we grew up in the same town and went to the same private, Christian academy, for our middle school and high school years. And, but you were a few years ahead of me. And so we weren't really friends. Actually, you have a brother who was, Jesse's a year younger than me. Is that right? I think.
Yes.
Yeah. So I was like more friends with Jesse or in the, you know, age range of Jesse. And then at some point later down the road, you and I met again at, like, after we're both out of high school.
I think it was after you'd had your first baby, because after you had Finley, we went to a outdoor theater performance with a group of people.
Were you visiting your parents there in the summer or something?
Was.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So you were in college, or I guess we were both out of college, and you were visiting your parents back in this small town in Western New York. And I was loosely connected with some friends that your mom was friends with. And I think it was Lori Huth, maybe, invited everybody, you know, in Buffalo, New York, there was this Shakespeare in the Park. And I think you and I were the two youngest people there. Mm-hmm. And I was Caitlin, I know you, and mm-hmm. I know Jesse, and we've kind of orbited the same community, but never really actually crossed paths. And either you or I don't remember who recommended me, I would like to get to know you more. Can we be pen pals?
Right.
And you're my only real true pen pal that I've ever had, I think.
At that point you were already making work and I was working at a museum. So
yeah.
There were it was clear that we had overlapping investments, interests.
Mm-hmm. It's just, I just find our friendship interesting, because I don't know, other friends in my life, there's a much more linear, trajectory. but I feel our friendship has kind of woven in and out of these different stages of our life, mm-hmm. in unique ways. but that aside, I just love that you mentioned that about, the school, because I also, and I've shared this on the podcast before, I've had the same experience of you had to choose art or music. And the music program at our school was very strong. The teacher was well known and wonderful. And, a lot of a lot of students were involved in the music program. So it was a much bigger pull socially and, for lots of reasons, to be involved in the music program, even though I too was dang it, why do I have to choose? I kind of think I'm interested in art,
Mm-hmm.
And it was just, I don't know. I think about that a lot, because and some of it is rooted in insecurity. I wish I had known earlier that I wanted to be an artist,
right.
And, mm-hmm. and I feel like that moment really, was something that limited me, I guess. I'll mm-hmm. just say that. So it's nice to hear you say that as well.
Yeah.
And also I had your dad in college, and I just, want to bring up him again one more time. And, cause I know both your parents are so influential to you and such wonderful people. And, he was an amazing teacher when I had him, and, I can't imagine what it was like to grow up with him and his, love of stories as, a child. So.
Well, yeah. And I love stories, but also a deep appreciation for the art of children's literature illustration.
Yes.
He always would get so upset when people would dismissively call it kiddie lit, because he
yes.
felt like these stories and these images are so formative and are can be powerful when they're, when it's quality for adults as well as for children.
Yeah. And I wondered, I actually just thinking about this, when we lived in Houghton, I remember, taking Finley to the campus library, because there was a great children's section in this academic, undergraduate college library, that the basement had this really good, mm-hmm. children's section, almost like it was a community library, mm-hmm. which it was for many people in the town. But, I wonder, I'm assuming your dad contributed to that greatly. And I just think too now of the library that my husband's a college professor at the library at his college. We aren't even allowed in. I've tried to go in with the kids, and they're we don't have kids books. You're not allowed. We don't
wow.
want kids in here. And
wow.
it's just the day that happened, I was so irate, but, it just the culture too of,
yeah.
the academic community that you and I grew up in, I think was, partly influenced by your dad, but was very welcoming.
Well, yeah. Right. And other artists. I mean, as you know full well, there are lots of amazing, being in a tiny rural town in a very small college, there are lots of really amazing artists. And because it was such a small community, there was a lot of integration among the faculty and the students and the local community. And so I should also say, like, even though we grew up in a very rural area and I didn't go to museums very often until I was a teenager, we grew up with primarily original art on our walls, which is a huge privilege, I realize looking back. But it was because my parents were friends with these people, or, you know, they would purchase work from students who were in the studio art BA program. Mm-hmm. And so there was a real, I think for me, it's not just kind of, you know, images in a two-dimensional way, but a real kind of abiding care for an investment in objects, whether they were paintings or prints or ceramics, that really kind of percolated throughout my childhood, even if it wasn't talked about in a way like, oh, this is art, because it was just in our house.
Right. Yeah, I think that's an important thing to think about, too, in the context of where you and I grew up, because I know you and I also, there's things that we feel very... that did not represent our values and our lifestyles, living in a rural, small, mostly white area in, you know, the U.S. So it's mm-hmm. just nice to, like, think about the ways that it did influence us for positive moving forward.
Right.
Okay, so tell me more about, like, you went into undergrad and eventually decided to go to a PhD program at Yale for art history. So, like, what got you to that point?
So as an undergrad, I ended up went to a small liberal arts school where you had the opportunity to do what they called a self-determined major, which I didn't set out to do initially. And I actually ended up minoring in art history. So I did take some art history. I did take a little bit of studio art, like drawing and ceramics while I was there. That's when I actually got into ceramics. But I was just feeling like I was restricted by these core requirements for all the different majors. And so my foray into this self-determined major in philosophy and poetry and aesthetics and theory was really just a way to kind of formulate a path to take what I wanted to take and avoid what I didn't really want to take as much as possible. And so that, that kind of... coursework that I did allowed me to both be making, to be writing my own poetry, to be looking at art. I also started working at the Tang Teaching Museum and Art Gallery, which is at Skidmore, where I went to college. And that was my first introduction to curatorial work and museum work. And so that was also, on the one hand, I had this academic coursework that allowed me to kind of explore these different questions about aesthetics and making and vision and sensation and memory and the body and all of these kind of core ideas that are still at the heart of what I'm interested in studying and writing about and thinking about today. But I also, at a very practical level, sort of had this experience of realizing, like, oh, museum work or curatorial work or research is like a job that one could have in the world, mm-hmm. which I think I just wasn't something that was kind of part of my kind of sphere of experience previously. And so after college, I ended up going to Washington, D.C. and working at a couple of museums there. And then after a couple of years there, realized I was mostly working as an editor within a curatorial department and was starting to feel like I had kind of reached a point at which I wanted to be the one doing the thinking and the writing rather than just editing and forming other people's projects. So that led me to another kind of fork in the road where I applied to two master's programs. I applied to one of the only, or maybe the only, fully funded MFA programs in poetry in the U.S. and master's in philosophy that with a focus in aesthetics and art theory. And so I didn't get into the MFA and I did get into the philosophy master's. And so that kind of was what decided mm-hmm. that particular path. And I was still writing poetry all along as well. But so I moved to New York and did that master's in a year and a half. And that was also a really interesting juncture for me, being within a philosophy department, an academic philosophy department, but specifically focused on questions of making and looking at art and interpreting art and responding to art. And a number of our teachers, the faculty there, are also active artists in their own right. And one of them, Megan Craig, you had on your podcast this past spring. And she's amazing. I think being in that environment with people who are keyed into not just theoretical questions, but also these processes of artistic production led me to think really seriously about, okay, if I do want to go on to a PhD, do I really want to do a philosophy PhD, which essentially just leads you to teaching in an academic setting. And I decided in the end that I would apply to art history PhD programs because it would open up more opportunities to do curating, to do research, or to teach academically.
Right.
And so that was kind of what led me to Yale. And I should say, like, I had a lot of ambivalence going into that about whether I even wanted to do a PhD, just because the state of the university system is, I'm sure many of the listeners are aware, is really changing and moving away from kind of more stable jobs towards kind of adjunct and term hires. And so I had, and to some extent still grapple with, ambivalence about kind of how much of the rest of my life am I willing to sacrifice or compromise for this academic role that right. I'm pursuing. So I ended up at Yale, and I particularly was drawn to Yale because it was a program that, while in some ways it's, you know, a very traditional art history program, the department is also really open to, I found, to interdisciplinary work and to working across departments, and for students to work with a lot of different faculty. It's not one of these kind of acolyte hierarchical formats where you go in and you just work with one person that you right. go to work with. And so for me, that was incredibly productive because I felt really supported to pursue a lot of different facets of modern and contemporary art and art history.
Mm. Yeah, it's interesting to think about those specific junctures and like how we end up choosing one way or another and, you know, how that influences sort of the next phase of your life.
Right.
So now you completed your PhD this past summer, or I guess last year, because now we're in 2020. So in 2019, right. you completed your
May.
PhD.
Mm-hmm.
And then began another, like, okay, so now, well, not only were you at a junction for your own career, it's like, okay, now I've completed the highest degree I can get. I've done school, and now I kind of have these options and paths. But you were also married at that point, and mm-hmm. so then you had a partner who has a career that you have to consider, and you had one daughter and a son on the way at the point of your graduation, right?
Right.
You had Dimitri like 2 months after you graduated.
Yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I think too, like, about not only, you know, you moving through the world as like an independent being, but then as you've jumped through these specific phases, you've also added other people that are now beholden to you.
Right.
And so I'm curious, you know, to hear you talk a little bit about what your life looks like now and how those different roles as spouse and mother have influenced sort of how you shaped your present.
Yeah, it's super tricky, right?
Like
trying to figure out how to navigate all this. And I have to say, like, a number of my colleagues from my cohort at Yale, the vast majority are single or at least childless. Mm-hmm. And I do have to say there are moments where I look with some envy upon their ability to, you know, kind of do research or go to conferences mm-hmm. or, you know, pursue jobs, thinking only about kind of their own interests and not having to worry about a nursing baby and how you're going to handle all that. But
right.
I do think, I mean, and this is a comment that some of those same colleagues have said to me, that they feel like having a family and having these other kind of demands on my time also, I think, has helped to shape the kind of scholar and teacher and writer that I am in really beneficial and probably healthy ways, that my life is not singularly focused just on being an art historian.
Right.
But I have these other both things that I'm cultivating, like my own poetry or art projects I'm working on, but also just the fact that that there are these kind of checks and balances. So, I mean, in terms of navigating that, so my husband is an architect, and so he's not the most flexible or like work-life balance positive kind of field for whatever reason. One benefit of having, so I had my daughter Ariadne maybe 6 months after I had my dissertation project approved. And so it actually was, even though it wasn't planned that way, it was probably the most amazing way that we could have planned it, because I had this incredible flexibility to do my work, but to do it on my own schedule and to be home with her a lot.
Yeah.
Which I don't take for granted at all, especially having worked in museums previously where I would have gotten zero paid maternity leave and I would have just had to cobble together, you know, unpaid time or sick leave.
Right.
And so because of that, because of the kind of academic cadences and having that flexibility, I've been able to be really present in her life. She's now almost four, in a way that I treasure and I think has also shaped my own research. So what I work on is primarily post-World War II art, but as you said in my introduction, thinking about language and performance and media. But so it's been kind of amazing to have this life, this little person who's learning how to talk and how to express herself, how to tell stories, how to make jokes, who's painting and makes art and likes to look at art with me, all of these things, to be having that in my life alongside or kind of mirrored with the academic writing and research that I do. So I feel like the two inform each other in really productive ways. And particularly the research I was doing the last few years was about experimental sound poetry that doesn't use language but relies on the voice and on the body and a lot of kind of guttural vocalizations and body sounds that are then distorted through the artist manipulating tape recorders and microphones and things. And so sometimes they're very unsettling, but it's also always fun. Like, she listened to one of them in the exhibition that I curated this past fall, co-curated this past fall, and she just thought it was hysterical. Like, I think because it's like, you know, these kind of body sounds
and,
you know, it's like everyone else is very serious in the exhibition listening to these things and she's just over in the corner cracking up. So there's always this nice kind of rapport, I think, just partly because of what I work on, but also I think the questions that I'm interested in are also, of course, shaped by the fact that I had a child and now have a second child who's almost 6 months old. So I would say, in terms of navigating those things, it's also only possible because my father passed away a few years ago, and at that point in time, my mother moved to be near us. And so even though she's been working part time, she also has done a huge amount of childcare for us. And so that also is like a gift that I will never be able to repay to her, and a huge joy, I think, for her and for my daughter, and a relief for my husband and I to have someone that we love and trust taking care of Ariadne and now Dimitri as well. So I think I am in awe of single parents and people who are parenting and have two careers, who are living in places where they don't have family or a network of friends and support. Cause I don't know how we would do it otherwise.
Yeah. And I think too, I think of you as somebody who's kind of like, you went to Yale, this amazing program. And so you would assume that, you know, you kind of have these endless opportunities for jobs and the jobs are going to be ones that are really great. And it's just like, as your friend, I know how difficult it's been to sustain a family life that feels balanced, and knowing how much your mom has been a part of that. I think back to a few episodes ago, the the panel that I did at CCAC, the Artist Parent Academic Panel, and just how, like, you know, so much of what I talk about is like the artist mother overlap. But I think too, just like this academic world where you assume that like you have stability in your job and you have like, I don't know, better systems that are going to support you, but also like, I don't know, being an academic and it doesn't always shake out that way, you know?
Right.
Which is like, it's like just, you know, one of those things that you just want to shake somebody and say, yeah, you guys, like, right, what is it going to take?
Well, and it just seems like, I mean, I know it's easy for me to say, like, at least if you're an artist, you could potentially be making things with your child occupied in the space. Like, mm-hmm, I know that that's not always the case, but it really just is not possible for me to be reading something in German and taking notes and then writing like with my 3-year-old kind of bopping around.
Right.
And so I think that's like the flexibility and the mobility is amazing, but it doesn't diminish the fact that I, at least for how I work, I have to have kind of independent time carved out to do that work.
Right.
I can't kind of do it multitasking. And I think the academy is getting better. Like I know I was sort of warned before I got pregnant that there would be pushback, but I actually found nothing but support from my department at Yale. And I really am grateful for that. And there are a handful of faculty, men and women, who have young kids who I think have really kind of vocally stood up to support students. Even like ridiculous things, like they had changing tables put in both the men's and women's restrooms in the art history building, or in one of the restrooms, so that it not just practically could help students, but also as a signal, like it's
right,
okay to bring your babies to work in this space.
Right.
And so
that they,
I
should
think,
be in men's restrooms as well.
Right.
Like,
right.
That it like infuriates right, me where, you know, where we live is in the South. It's just less common. And my husband is the one who changes the majority of the diapers. So I'm like, I don't know what, I guess you'll just have to use the floor. I don't know.
Right.
You know?
Yeah. Well, although I will say that like, it is true, though, still that the research shows, like, for example, for academics, that when women, when female faculty take maternity leave, like, they take that leave to care for the child and mm-hmm, to recover from pregnancy and birth, whereas men who take it, who take parental leave, typically, you know, they're still helping at home, but they use that to kind of further their publication projects. Like, they use that relief time from teaching and from committee work to, you know, get work done. And so there's, even though there are these, you know, on the surface, it's these advancements being made that, of course, like, it's great that there's parental leave, not just maternity leave offered, but how that actually plays out in terms of people's careers and meeting the publications, you know, guidelines right, that they need to meet to be able to get tenure, of course, is a different reality on the ground.
Right. Caitlin, I want to hear your perspective a little bit more on motherhood, and then we'll kind of dive back into art to wrap up the interview. But I'm, you know, just curious to hear for you how it's been transitioning from very supportive, you know, environment at Yale that you felt secure in. And then once you graduated, it was like, okay, I kind of got to make a change here and go find a position. And I just think, you know, it's wonderful that you've like experienced a lot of these big things at the same time, but I know it's been a challenge and, you know, just a lot on your plate at once.
Yeah.
So I'm curious to hear a little bit about, the more behind the scenes of just like being a mom right now in this phase of your life.
Yeah. So I think the last year, like the last winter and spring, at the time it was kind of like, I just did what I had to do to finish my dissertation, defend it, work on this exhibition I was curating, organized 2 conferences that I was getting paid to organize, like for extra money because we needed it because I wouldn't have income over the summer, and also be pregnant and be on the academic job market, which is, as you alluded to, extremely stressful and also uncertain. And I think from the outside, it seems like, oh, of course, like you have a degree from Yale, it will be like not difficult for you to get a position. But the reality, of course, is that there are very few positions and so many qualified people.
Right.
and so many variables that go into these decisions. So it was, looking back, an extremely stressful time. And I feel like it took me a good maybe 6 months after kind of graduating in May and everything being wrapped up to kind of process everything and to recover, basically, kind of physically and mentally and emotionally. And then, of course, we also welcomed a baby in July and then moved when he was about 3 weeks old from New Haven to Williamstown. So it has felt a little nonstop. And I think in that way, hard, because I feel like after my daughter was born, I had 6 months at home where I was really just with her. Everything else was, you know, I had other things going on in my personal life, but the kind of basic structure of our lives was pretty consistent and peaceful. Mm-hmm. And this time around, there's been a lot more upheaval. And my daughter is like a very sensitive child, and the move has been really hard for her. She had really close friends in New Haven, and we've been here almost 5 months, and she still asks every week when we're moving back and talks about wanting to see these friends.
I don't mean to interject in a negative way, but Finley, as you know, my oldest is almost 8, and he wants to move back to New York still. And he was 2.5.
We might have a few more years.
Yeah. Like he's like, you know, I mean, he loves our life here, but he just, I think part of it is they're like, to the parent, you know, when they're, because he was 2.5 when we moved here. And to me, I'm like, he's still so little. He's not even going to remember any of this. It's like going to be behind him. But really, I think those, you know, from like age 1 to age 2, like we think they're still babies, and they're not maybe making as many connections to people. But man,
it's super formative. Yeah. Especially if like, you have and for you guys having family there too, I'm sure it's like, there's this pull.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's just been surprising to me to realize how connected he felt, even though he was 2.5 when we moved here.
So. Yeah, they're really sensitive and aware. Mm-hmm. And I get it, right? Like, we miss New Haven. Like, my husband and I miss New Haven and our community there. Like, even though that was already, you know, had changed, I think, so that had already changed a lot, because the vast majority of our friends, you know, they'd finished their PhDs and were moving elsewhere. But we did have this small community that had sort of just blossomed in the previous 6 months of other families with kids my daughter's age. Mm. And so I think that for me has been a loss, like suddenly moving to this tiny town, which, even though you'd think there'd be a community here, it still has the kind of, you know, we're still new, and there's the kind of New England chill. It hasn't been quite the smooth adjustment that I think I had probably naively thought it would be. Because I think I sort of thought, like, we're coming with kids, so it's actually easier. Like, it'd be really hard to be here as like a single 35-year-old, maybe. But I think, yeah, it'll be a matter of time. And for now, it's kind of, you know, I'm at the Clark in my capacity as a postdoc, organizing scholarly colloquia and conferences. So I have interaction with these art historians and artists and curators who come to the Clark for these events or to do research. So I have that kind of academic and art world milieu and people that I have a chance to speak with. But then outside of that, our lives are kind of still pretty, you know, we're at home. My husband's cobbling together freelance architecture projects. My mother moved here with us, so she's helping with childcare. So it still feels kind of like a balancing act. Mm. Like we're kind of keeping all these balls in the air. And, you know, I'm also working on like a book proposal and working on some articles to send out to journals. So I'm also trying, you know, not just trying, but actively as part of my postdoctoral position, working on my own research. And then of course it's, I think, there's the kind of horizon for anyone in 2020 is that there's not a whole lot of necessarily job security, but particularly because my position is just a 2-year position, we're trying to feel settled here while also knowing that we'll be moving again in another year, year and a half. And so I think.
And academic jobs take so long to process. So I'm sure you're already like, you know, kind of thinking ahead. Mm-hmm. Like, I just imagine, you know, I know kids keep you grounded and in the moment, but also, you know, that it's like, how can you not think ahead when you almost have to, you know?
Right. Yeah. Everything's a kind of year schedule or whatever.
Yeah.
So it's, I think my focus now is on rather than kind of like having the answers for what's next, trying to focus on learning to be a little more comfortable in the discomfort of not knowing, which we've been getting good at for the last year. Because it was also like, this was the case last spring when I was finishing my dissertation and on the job market and going to interviews, it was kind of like, well, we could be ending up in California. We could be ending up in Massachusetts. Like, who knows where we'll be. So I think, it's just the nature of the field.
Yeah. But you and I are both learning that lesson of not being so forward thinking and preparing ahead, but just, I don't know.
Right. And I'm very type A. Like, I want to have control and too. I want to be able to plan. So it's like, it's a real lesson in kind of giving over that that impulse.
Yeah. And you want to like perfect and, you know, improve your life as much as you can to like for everyone in your circle, you know. So I just imagine too, like how much Ariadne's discomfort and feelings of loneliness is impacting, you know, your desire to make her life better and, you know, like wondering if, you know, this was the right job for you and all that. It's hard to parse that out when you have little tender people.
And even Dimitri, who's, you know, not even 6 months old, like he's been a much more kind of unsettled baby than Ariadne was. And then I wonder, like, well, is it because he has reflux and like, or did he really have colic, or was it just that there was so much stress around the move right after he was born and getting settled, and there were some problems when we came here, you know, with the house and stuff? Like, is it really us kind of, you know, is he just surfacing all of these other kind of stresses? And I'm probably a mix. But yeah, it's like the family really is an organism in that way. I think it's hard, you know, it's not just me having this like great postdoc at a great institution. It's a lot more complicated than that.
Right. Okay, let's segue back to talking about some of the art that you study and are interested in and some of the ways that you've engaged through curating and some other practices. I'm interested to like hear, lots of things. There's lots of things I could ask you about this, but I guess first, like why like the specific field of art that you went into, the like cross between, you know, sound and like post-war. I know you spent a lot of time in France, doing a lot of studying in that. So could you just talk a little bit more about sort of what your specialty is in what you've researched and, why you chose that as sort of, your track?
Sure. Well, I have to say, choosing it, sometimes it feels like I stumbled into it rather than actively choosing it. It seems like at so many, as I already alluded to with my kind of path to where I am today, at so many points in time, it seems like there's an opportunity has arisen or a question has been raised or there's been something I've been curious about and I've sort of followed that morsel or taken that opportunity, and it's opened on to this whole other path that I couldn't have kind of engineered myself. And that was very much the case for the specific research I'm doing, that the Beinecke Rare Book and Manuscript Library, which is in New Haven, affiliated with Yale, had the papers of a number of the artists that I ended up writing about in my dissertation. And they had recently been acquired. No one had really looked at them yet. And so I just saw an opportunity there to mine material that was in New Haven and readily accessible, and that, you know, I wasn't going to be writing about Picasso or Matisse or someone who already has had a lot written about them, but that I would be, you know, maybe not recuperating artists on the margins, but, trying to tell a story about post World War II art that's more complex and more complicated. And I'm really interested in sort of, interrelations, not just across practices like, you know, music and performance and visual art and writing, but But also these kind of networks of association among these different artists who are making these, you know, quirky arts journals and magazines together, or mm-hmm. forming these different kind of groups. And so this particular group of artists allowed me to think about some of those questions of kind of collaboration and the way that artists pursue certain questions, but across different media, and what leads them to pursue something in a sound recording versus in a an artist book versus in a painting or a collage. Mm-hmm. And so it just was really rich material for the questions I was interested in asking. And I think for me, choosing modern and contemporary art in some ways as my focus, in some ways just felt like a natural outgrowth of my interest in and my background in philosophy, because so many artists in the last 60 or 70 years in particular have been very self-consciously consumed and working through questions, sort of conceptual questions, or political questions, social questions, in a way that, you know, was latent and sometimes explicit previously, but I think is much more overtly thematized, and not just like in conceptual art, you know, as such, but in other, you know, abstract painting practices mm-hmm. and things as well. And so in some ways it just was like a natural kind of outgrowth of the kinds of questions I wanted to ask. Although I have to say, sometimes I kind of wistfully wish that I worked on early Netherlandish painting or something like that, because I love these other periods of art, earlier periods of art. And I think there's really rich opportunities to think about, you know, construction of individual subjectivity and social identity and all of these kinds of questions in, you know, across art history, not just in the last century. So, but it is what it is. And now I sort of am where I am.
Right.
But the question of sound is sort of, I feel like I kind of had to squirrel away for a while to kind of update myself on kind of experimental music and sound studies research from the last decade or so, because it was not something that I had thought about. But it's something that's very much a part of the practice of the artists that I chose to write about and to research.
Is your specialty, I mean, I don't like the word specialty, but is most of your research dedicated to that specific time period? I know it was for your dissertation, but like mm-hmm. now, you know, are you also engaging with work like sort of this cross between sound and multimedia work from artists that are more contemporary, or are you still more rooted in like the post-war generation?
Still more rooted in the post-war generation, but that's also a product of just sort of where I'm at in my career. Like right now I'm kind of, you know, revising the dissertation for a book manuscript and cannibalizing it a little bit for articles. So it's partly just pragmatically, mm-hmm. I'm still
that's what you spend your
entrenched
time. You're
in that
a
material
research institution. Yeah.
Right at that moment. And I've done a little bit, like even at Yale, a little bit of writing and working with some of the MFA students who are there. Although unfortunately, like the MFA program at Yale and the art history department are in some ways sort of siloed, although as grad students and among the faculty, we really were working to kind of bring those two worlds together. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I'm definitely focused more on the kind of, you know, 1950 to through the 1970s, more so than really okay. contemporary practice in terms of my research and writing. Like it's not that I'm not interested in thinking about and looking at the more contemporary work, but I would say I fall more in the post-war modern side of things.
Well, and when you curate, though, I'm assuming that's when you can pull in more contemporary artists and...
Yeah, depending on, so like the curatorial project I did in the fall was at the Beinecke, and it was working from their holdings. So those were predominantly, you know, from 1950 to 1980 or so. Although we did have like one of the artists who has work in the collections there is in his 80s, but is still alive. And he came and we created a new public, he calls them public poems, a performance, kind of embodied performance with myself and a number of other people using letters, sort of roving through the streets of New Haven. So there are I have found opportunities mm-hmm. to engage with contemporary work. But I mean, they're also, so sort of away from the dissertation, the other direction I'm going is thinking about other artists who are a little bit more contemporary, like Carolee Schneemann, who passed away recently. But I was actually hoping to plan a trip to the Getty Institute because they have her papers there. And there's some work that she did in the 60s that intersects with some of the artists who intersect with the artists that I wrote about in my dissertation. So there's also these kind of like pebble thrown right. in the water kind of ripple effects that I'm interested in tracing out some of these connections, in particular to think about women artists, like the artists I wrote about in my dissertation are three straight white European men.
Yeah, that's what I was going to, that's part of like what I was getting at was I was just curious if there were any women that you could include because, you know, your dissertation was so specific to location and media and, you know, and obviously the time frame. I was just curious, like, how many women were you, like, were, and I know, you know, saying this too from a friend perspective, like, I know you and your background, and I'm sure if you could have written a dissertation on women artists in the 50s, you maybe would have, but yeah.
There were a few on the, sort of on the margins and of the kind of main core group, but that's kind of the direction I'm going now is expanding to not just be about artists based in France and also not just be white men.
Okay. So Caitlin, tell me a little bit about what it's like to sort of be and exist in the art world, to do all this research and be so engaged in artists' lives and sort of the collection of writing and reading that is formed around them, but not actually do much practical, you know, artwork yourself. Like I'm sure there must be this tension, and I know you actually do some writing, and you know, you have like small threads of creative practices in your life, but you wouldn't call yourself a studio artist.
Correct.
So right. I'm just interested to hear you talk sort of about that tension of like being and existing in the art world and advocating for artists and thinking and talking about artists, but maybe struggling to call yourself an artist yourself.
Yeah. I mean, I think because for the last 7 years, I've been so enmeshed in the kind of art historical and academic world or curatorial world, it doesn't feel like a tension so much as just that this is the role that I have chosen to take on and embraced. And I very much would not consider myself an artist or a studio artist, you know, maybe a writer or a poet, but not an artist. And I think being at institutions, for example, where I am now, the Clark Art Institute, I interact a lot with the curatorial staff here. And so there's a kind of, there's a way in which I feel like the questions of curating an exhibition and how to display and think about and reflect on objects are very much still a part of my, my sort of daily life and my own research, but not a whole lot of interaction with artists themselves, except insofar as certain events, colloquia that we organize. For example, we organized one in November on performance art that was amazing because it was the first time that there was around the seminar table at the Clark, it was predominantly young women of color who are curators, artists, performance artists. And so I feel like there are these junctures in which I sort of opportunities to make connections and to talk with artists. And in that case, I really do see my role as being, you know, a critic, but also perhaps an advocate. And I guess for me personally, I don't feel a tension of not being an artist, except perhaps insofar as depending on what I'm writing about, I would like to have a more sophisticated or complex understanding of the kind of material properties of what I'm writing about.
Yeah.
And this is actually, these are conversations I've been having at the Clark this past fall with some of the scholars who've come in. And there are other art historians who are also feeling this way. I met one art historian who's gotten super involved in making her own pigments because she realized, like, I'm writing about these abstract mid-century paintings, but I don't really know what the paint is that I'm writing about.
Right.
And so I think, you know, there are all kinds of ways to kind of remedy some of that disconnect. But I think for me, the more acute tension would be, so I write poetry and I write criticism or essays, I write scholarly work, but can I call myself a writer or a poet? Like, I think I've always kind of shied away from those identifiers. Like, even, you know, on my website, it says like art historian and writer. I would describe myself as an art historian and poet. And that's only in the last like year that I've changed that. I used to just say like, I do art history, or art history is my field, or I write poetry. It was always like in the active kind of verb form.
Right.
And so for better or worse, I'm kind of trying on what it feels like to embrace some of these, identifiers, in a different way.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's like true to, you know, the life and, identity of an artist too. It's like, what do I need to be? What needs to come under the label before I can actually capitalize that A and call myself an artist? You know, do I need to have an exhibition? Do I need to have poetry published, you know, somewhere? Do I need to have poetry published once a year or once in my life? Like, you know, like what, what does that mean?
I think for me, like one of the lessons maybe has been, and this goes back to what I was saying a while ago about the kind of external validation versus my internal sense of self and fulfillment, is that I think having kind of gone through this PhD, and, you know, now I have a PhD in art history, but I still feel often a deep insecurity about like, what do I have to say about these things, or kind of what argument like could I make about these works, or in what ways could I advocate for an artist? Like, a lot of uncertainty about that. And so I think I've just realized that that's just something that I, and I'm sure many other people, it's a process and something to kind of be aware of and work through, and that there's never going to be a moment perhaps in my life where I feel that external validation in a way that I finally have kind of settled that tension once and for all. Right. And so that's work that I need to do, or a reflection that I need to do, to feel a sense of confidence and groundedness in my own interests and arguments and way forward. And because I'm not going to, I don't think, get that from the outside.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you. And why for would sharing
I want,
that.
Why would I want to, too? Right. I mean, it's sort of like, I mean, I've just been thinking about this a lot in the last few months too. You know, as I mentioned, like knowing that this postdoc is just for 2 years, and kind of like, well, what is next? Like, am I, like, I want to teach. I would love to teach in a university setting, but if that doesn't pan out for one reason or another, like, what do I want? What am I going to do?
Right.
So there's a lot of, you know, thinking about a lot of these questions now, or as Rilke would say, kind of living the questions without answers.
Right. Mm. Thank you for sharing that. Okay. So I have two more questions for you, and then we're going to have you read a poem or two before we wrap up.
Great.
So second to last question, I love this question because I feel like it's, again, just opens up the space for people to really talk about what's important to them. I'm curious to hear what success means to you. Or what does success look like for you? What's your ideal, you know?
Yeah, I think this is exactly, like, I think I just wrote this in my journal last night too. I was like, you know, what is my ambition, like, in this whole process of jumping through all these academic hoops and kind of climbing whatever, I don't like that metaphor, but kind of working my way through this process. What do I want? And I think for me, that sense of success or fulfillment would come from, being able to do work that I feel like, whether it's research and or poetry or curating, to do work that I feel a sense of, has a sense of meaning to it, to me. And I personally feel a sense of satisfaction with it, and to have it out in the world in some way. Mm-hmm. Like, it doesn't mean that it needs to be, you know, a celebrated book or something, but that I think, to some extent, I'm happy to write poetry for myself and to share with kind of inner circle, or I'm happy to reflect on art in that way. But I think for me, there, I do want it to be in relationship to other people. So whether that's however that looks, I think the community aspect and having a dialogue about these things and having feedback, or feeling like the work I'm doing is informing a broader social discussion about, for example, women artists or art that's multisensorial rather than just focused on vision. And more recently, I've been thinking about, you know, kind of next project, like how can I do a project that speaks more to some of these deep-seated concerns that I have about climate change and about other kind of really pressing, devastating, troubling issues in our world today. I think for me, sometimes it's hard to feel like, you know, does what I'm doing even really matter? Like, yeah. to what extent does this, you know, 400-page dissertation about weird, amazing sound poetry in 1960, like, what is that doing for the world? Right. I mean, that sounds very grandiose, but like, what am I adding, I guess, to the conversation with whatever I put out? And so those are questions that I'm trying to think about for myself and to use that process of reflection to calibrate kind of what I do next or what I do with the writing and research I've already done. Mm. And I think for me also sustaining, you know, not just kind of eclipsing all my other interests in favor of pursuing, you know, a tenure track job or something, but sustaining, you know, making watercolors with my daughter and
going,
you know,
to the
making,
farmer's market.
And teaching and practicing yoga and writing, like all these other parts of my life are also important to me. And I, as I said before, I think they feed in to my research and my thinking in all kinds of productive ways that I can't maybe even identify.
Thank you. Okay. Last question. I just see you as someone who has, you know, spent so much time learning how to read, write, think about and look at art. So I thought maybe you could close with like a couple, I don't know, just like tips or reflections for artists who maybe come from a more like studio background and don't get a lot of time in museums or don't have like a great practice of researching and reading as part of their studio practice, as part of like their engagement with work. Could you maybe just like give a few tips for people? Just like, how do you hone a critical eye? How do you walk into a museum and think like, what kinds of things do you think about in relation to how you approach a work and when you're looking at it? And like how can we become better thinkers and viewers of artwork?
Well, I don't know that I feel like I'm in a position to be able to offer a great deal of wisdom, but I think just asking the questions and just, you know, reading and having the conversations and seeing the work, whether it's in books or magazines, journals, or whether it's in a museum setting, I think, you know, rather than kind of just, I mean, I'm sure that there are times where one needs to sequester oneself with one's work and one's own processes to not kind of have the constant barrage of feedback or other input from outside. But it seems like to be able to keep your work in dialogue with art historical precedents and other contemporary work would be really important. And also, I think when you're like in talking with curators or critics or writers or art historians or other artists, to realize that there's a kind of specificity to the questions and the practices or processes that you as an artist are invested in. And that specificity gives you a particular perspective or an eye or a way of thinking from which to speak from or to share from that is different from everyone else's. Like, I think that's something I realized doing studio visits with some of the MFA students that I think that they often at Yale, I think they often felt like they could speak about their work, but that they didn't have the kind of like theoretical or art historical apparatus to kind of expand out. And I always felt like I didn't have the kind of material, tangible knowledge to speak to their work specifically in the way that I wanted to. So there's a kind of potential, really generative meeting point between those two places of having a real kind of exchange that's generative for me and informative for me as well as for them. Mm. The one thing that I always do when I go to museums is rather than moving kind of linearly through the room, I just kind of hop around based on where the fewest people are, because it allows me to get close to the work, to step back from the work, to see it from different angles. It's actually one reason I don't like going to museums with other people and kind of sticking together the whole time, because I like to just be able to float around. And as soon as someone leaves a painting that I want to see up close or a sculpture I want to see up close, I can kind of dart in and stake out my spot.
Thank you for sharing that. I think it's just, I don't know, because I mostly interview studio artists, I think there's, you know, a vacuum that our conversations sometimes can get sucked into. And I'm appreciative of anybody who can like bring us back out into the other realms of the ways that people think and talk about art. I think it's important to have variety.
Well, I love hearing your conversations with other studio artists. That's why I listen to the podcast.
Well, maybe it can help enrich your understanding of material and
exactly.
Yeah. Like the kind of the inside, what an artist is thinking and processing. Okay. So can you read us a couple poems? Do you still have time?
Yeah, sure. Okay. So this first one is called Planting Moon. And I should say, I specifically picked poems that had to do with motherhood, given the context of the podcast. Planting Moon. I am learning our woods, black birch, hickory, sugar maple, nuthatch, robin, junco, jay, hyssop, catkins, yarrow, blameberry. Before, I was sated on the basis of sensation. It was enough just to notice tone and texture, scent and shape and shadow. But I want to give you maidenhair, milkweed, chickadee, sparrow, white pine, red oak, rock cress, chicory, naming as an act of knowing, a litany of attention that itself is a poetry. You call my name and something opens, a swallow, my wild indigo, by heart I learn you. And the next poem is one that's still in process, which feels like maybe a bad decision to share.
No, it's good.
We'll see. So this one's called Labyrinth and then subtitled Afterbirth. What you hear first is the whole of your making. For months, I was but a dark cadence of blood, breath, footstep, my interiority a world complete. So too is your cord a double path, a thread toward inner and outer worlds, each sating, each unknown. Now you pass into the time of the world. Now for a moment, we are still one, exquisite corpse, but now in one breath, a small wet cry on my chest, shiny eyes and earlobe tucked under, wholly other, at once strange and so familiar. It was you all along. And tell me, what is not nature? Until we have faces, blue the tidal heat of the body, blue the sound of a world opening.
I don't know. What can you make better about that? That was pretty great.
Thanks for the vote of confidence.
Of course. That was beautiful. Thanks for sharing. Okay, Caitlin. So final five questions just for us to get to know you a little better. I'm interested to know what you're currently reading. Outside of work.
Sure.
For pleasure.
Well, actually, my husband just picked up a stack of books that I interlibrary loaned from the library yesterday. And he was like, are these all yours? And there were like 10. There were like 10 of them. And I was like, yes. And he was like, that seems a little optimistic, don't you think? I'm trying to make my way through this book called The Uninhabitable Earth, which is about climate change. And it's harrowing, but really important. But also, I find, especially while I'm still breastfeeding, it's like really hard for me to read dark things and not feel deeply affected. So that one I'm slowly making my way through. I just finished Carmen Maria Machado, who's mostly written short stories, but she published a memoir this past year called The Dream House that is a sort of experimental form memoir about her experience in an abusive queer relationship. So clearly I'm not doing a good job of not reading the dark material. But And the last thing I finished recently that I would highly recommend as well is the author, Mexican-American author Valeria Luiselli wrote a book that came out, I think, in 2018 called The Archive of Lost Children, which is about kind of a family's dissolution, but also the border crisis. But it was particularly interesting to me working on sound and art because the two protagonists are sound documentarians. Oh, and wow. So there's a lot of attention in her writing to sounds rather than just kind of story and vision, which I think is really unusual in a novel. So I highly recommend her work.
Thank you. Okay. What about, like, is there anything you're currently binge watching with Nico, your husband? Do you guys watch any Netflix shows?
I'm afraid we don't. We don't really watch shows, but I did take my mom to see the new Little Women movie because it was our tradition as when I was growing up to watch like the night, whatever it was, 1995, whenever it came out, the one with that version.
Winona Ryder.
Susan Sarandon. We watched that one every Christmas.
Yeah, so. we try to. My mom and Maggie and I went last night actually to see it.
So. Okay.
Did you like it?
Yeah, I did.
Yeah, it was good.
I have some caveats about the end, but.
Yes, me too. I'm like, I still haven't really processed the end, but anyway. Okay. What would you do if you had a whole weekend to yourself?
I would probably, write and read and go on long walks, do yoga. I would actually probably, to be honest, I would probably either take myself to the ocean if that were possible, or take myself to, Kripalu, which is a yoga institute that's not too far from where we live now. And they have amazing vegetarian and vegan food. That's part of the deal. It's in the mountains. There's hiking, lots of yoga. I'd probably just like take myself there for a weekend.
That sounds perfect. Okay. What is your beverage of choice?
Coffee in the morning and then sparkling water the rest of the time. I joke that I've created a monster because my daughter primarily drinks sparkling water rather than still water, which is completely my own doing.
That's funny. Okay. And finally, I like to close by offering, you a space to give a shout out to anybody who supports you in your work.
I would have to thank my husband and my mom primarily, since I think they are just the two that have encouraged me and supported me and, also facilitated the work I do by being so involved with our kids.
Okay, Caitlin, where can people find you?
I have a website. There's not a lot of material on it, but it does have information about my research and writing at caitlinwolsey.com.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for taking the time. This was such a pleasure.
Thank you so much, Caitlin, and thanks for all the work you're doing with the podcast and creating community for our people all over.
Thank you.
The Artist Mother podcast is curated and produced by Caitlin Butine. Music by Josh Middleton. Editing and mixing by John M. Butine. Please visit www.artistmotherpodcast.com for episode notes and to find out how you can further support this podcast.